And hello everyone, and thanks for coming. And I'm going to talk about fitness landscapes and the predictability of evolution. I started my lab roughly 1.5 years ago, and so that's why I think, like as an introduction, I don't need to show you the common diversity picture. I'm going to show you what we do at my lab. So we are interested in how populations adapt to challenging environments. And if you want to make it a little more applied, for example, one of the questions that we ask is how drug resistance evolves, but also in generally studying the processes that drive speciation and diversification. And kind of summarized like in a broad way, we're interested in the role of interactions in evolution, especially interactions in terms of epistasis. And so fundamentally, we're interested in the interplay of the different evolutionary processes. But as a model or a theoretician, and what we do is to study these processes using simple models. We usually evaluate them either using simulations or data. And we also use modeling to inform experimental design a priori. And today, for the first part of my talk, the great thing is that as a theoretician, I can just make it even simpler than Rich did it in his long-term experiment, because I can just exclude as many forces as possible and just focus on selection for the first part of the talk. So if we ask how organisms adapt to changing environments, there's a couple of questions that we are particularly concerned with. Firstly, how big or small are adaptive steps, and then in general, what is the role of selection versus genetic drift? But that also then leads to the question what the proportions of beneficial, neutral, and deleterious mutations are, and how these mutational effects will change depending on the environment. And then also the next question immediately is how mutational effects will change depending on the genetic background they are found in. And just to get us on the same page, when I talk about epistasis today, I'm talking about something that's basically pictured here, where we usually have some reference or wild type that has a normalized selection coefficient of 0 or a growth rate of 1. And then we look at the effect of different mutations here shown as two beneficial mutations. And we look at the double mutation, and so what this purple mutation does on the background of the green one or the other way around. And if it is more beneficial than what we think it would be by just looking at the separate mutations, then that's what I call positive epistasis. And if it does worse than what we expect, then that's what I would call negative epistasis. And that also allows us to look at the positive and negative epistasis when a beneficial and a deleterious mutations interact. So all these questions together, that somehow when you accumulate them, you can ask about the shape of the fitness landscape. And just to give you a little bit of an introduction here, so here's the famous picture from Wright's paper where he drew maybe the first fitness landscape as some topographic map, where genotype space would be basically on the screen, and then out of this there are color or the crosses here, they indicate fitness peaks or fitness valleys. And apart from just being very illustrative, if we knew a fitness landscape, this would give us information about the predictability and the repeatability of evolution. And at the same time, it also becomes increasingly simple to measure empirical fitness landscapes. And that is not only true in terms of intragenic interactions, but also there's also accumulating data on gene networks and pathways that could give us information about how things in the genome interact. But at this, and this has basically, all this together has led to an explosion of studies of fitness landscapes. And pretty much every day there's a new paper that I think I should read to learn more about what's going on in this area. However, at the same time, there are some big problems with fitness landscapes. Firstly, they are enormously complex because they are these, especially genotype fitness landscapes come as hypercubes that really have an exploding dimensionality. And it's also quite unclear whether there is any predictive potential that goes beyond just describing the specific fitness landscape that you've just built or assessed empirically. However, I think that the potential gain is rather high, because if we could use fitness landscapes, for example, to predict costs of antimicrobial resistance across environments, that would be quite awesome. So just to go back about to what we're doing in the lab, we study fitness landscapes in many different respects. Firstly, we're interested about in fitness landscapes in adaptation and in discovering how we can best measure fitness landscapes and whether we can actually predict evolution on fitness landscapes. But then we also study fitness landscapes in speciation, especially considering Dobzhansky-Mala genetic incompatibilities. And we want to we are studying the role of such incompatibilities during hybridization and speciation, and also the dynamics of such interactions over time. And finally, we apply fitness landscape theory to questions from disease, ranging from a new project in cancer over a collaboration that Rhys is involved in on antibiotic resistance, and also to viruses. And so what I'm going to talk about today is firstly something about fitness landscapes and adaptation and predictability, and then if there's still time, I'm going to talk a little bit about viruses and how they could adapt to mutagenic drugs. So during my postdoc, I was quite lucky to establish a collaboration with Ben Bolon's lab at the University of Massachusetts Medical School, who developed an approach of deep mutational scanning called Empiric, which allows us to look at very big data sets of the fitness effects of different mutations. And so today, all the data that I'm going to talk about from this project was actually obtained by Ryan, who was a former PhD student in that lab. And yeah, all of this also happened with my postdoc advisor, Jeff. So the great thing about this approach, so what they do is they actually create point mutant libraries of mutations that we are interested in and transform them into yeast. And then these mutations are analyzed by deep sequencing. The abundance of these mutations is analyzed through deep sequencing at several time points, such that we can estimate the selection coefficients in from these four compositions. And the great things about this approach is that firstly, you get the systematic high throughput sampling of hundreds of or thousands of chosen mutations, and that includes those that are actually strongly deleterious, such as even like stop codons and so on. So you can actually see the full distribution of fitness effects. Then, since they are done in bulk,
sorry, you're up.
These bulk competitions ensure that every population is actually indexed, so that all mutations grow in exactly the same environment. And finally, the range of the experiment is so short that we are very confident that there are no background mutations that could distort our results. So in the end, I mean, this is wrong, but in a way, this deep mutational scanning results in an almost evolution-free snapshot of the fitness landscape, because there's no new mutation happening. And of course, we are looking at allele frequencies, but we are not interested in actually kind of how the population evolves over time. It's just a snapshot of selection coefficients of mutations that we are interested in. As a modeler, if I look at this experiment, it's pretty clear what's happening there, and it's rather simple on the first view. So what's going on is that we have like a time here on the x-axis, and we put in many mutants that all start with their specific library size at the beginning of the experiment, and they grow with their specific exponential growth rates, and then we sample at these dashed lines. We just take sampling, which corresponds to a multinomial sampling of mutants, that is where the total number of draws corresponds to the number of sequencing reads we sample at each time point.
And so one of the questions we can ask is just statistically, what is the attainable experimental accuracy under a different a given experimental setup, and how is this affected by different experimental details, for example, the number and the timing of those samples, sequencing coverage, or the number of mutants. And so one thing that we did in order to give a better, like give some advice to people doing deep mutational scanning experiments is just to figure out the statistics of this experiment. And then my programmer in my lab, she actually implemented this into a nice little web tool. So if you ever want to run a deep mutational scanning experiment, I cannot promise you that this will actually give you the error that you will have in your experiment, because there are different error sources, and we only can account for the ones that we put into this model. But it can give you an idea of what your maximum accuracy is that you can get, and how you can best, for example, distribute the time points in your experiment to get the highest possible outcome of your specific experiment. You can even calculate the costs, actually, on the second page. I'm going to quickly go through a couple of things that we did during my postdoc, and that gave us basically a picture where we went from very like a very small scale fitness landscape to the big scale fitness landscape that I'm going to talk about later. So all the work that we did was based on this yellow highlighted area here in this heat shock protein 90 in yeast, and this area was back then chosen by then because it has very diverse amino acid properties, and such as like different amino acids, and some of them are exposed and some of them are buried. So it seems like a very good place to start if you can, if you have to restrict yourself to a small area of the protein. And so what we started out with was just it wasn't even like, I mean, it depends on whether you want to call it a fitness landscape. So if you go back to this picture of the fitness landscape, we at the beginning we only looked at single step mutations. So every possible mutation, one step mutation away from this reference type, and we compared what's then coming out, which is the distribution of fitness effects here, like with the fitness, the selection coefficient on the x-axis, and the frequency at which this was observed on the y-axis. We compared this across different environments. And one of the things that we found was that mutations that were beneficial in a challenging, in one of the environments, tended to be very deleterious in the other environments, here illustrated by this blue area where we found these beneficials, and that then often turned out to be deleterious in the, for example, in the standard condition. But then we also characterized the tail of this fitness distribution in order to look at how predictable or repeatable evolution could be. And we saw not only in yeast, but also in a different data set in influenza, that we found for the most challenging environment, we found this Fréchier-shaped tail of the fitness distribution, which indicates that there could be very strong beneficial mutations in such conditions, which would make the effect size rather unpredictable, but they're probably, if it's only a few of them, will make the actual mutation rather predictable. But then we wanted to move on to something that resembles more like a real multidimensional fitness landscape. So instead of just looking at one step towards one step in the fitness landscape, we took some of these mutations here that we produced before and fixed them, and again created a distribution of fitness effects on this fixed anchor mutation, such that we could look at epistasis between two mutations on a large scale. And what we found was that in that case, like for example, Fisher's geometric model, which is usually often used, did not really give us a very good representation of the amount of epistasis that we found, but a very simple biophysically motivated model that just has a concave fitness landscape was very good at actually resembling this high amount of negative epistasis that we saw. And so today what I'm going to talk about is this here, where we then chose some mutations and created the complete fitness landscape of 640 genotypes and looked into the shape of this fitness landscape and what it might tell us about adaptation. So for this data set, of course, we couldn't just make all possible combinations of all of these mutations at this, in this 9 amino acid region. So what we chose were a total of 13 mutations at 6 different amino acid positions. So here is the parental sequence that was taken from the lab strain. And then in these columns, you can see the different amino acids that we tested and their effects in this box whisker chart. And so what you can see is that, so these were taken from the whole experiment was performed in the high salinity environment, which was necessary because in the standard environment, we didn't find any beneficials in the first place. And it would have probably not been so interesting to just look into the interactions of neutral and deleterious mutations. But here what we chose were like some of the mutations that we identified as beneficial beforehand, but there's also some there that are that are not distinguishable from the wild type, and even one that seemed to be rather like slightly deleterious. And so we got all possible combinations of amino acid mutations, which resulted in this fitness landscape of 640 amino acid genotypes.
Do you have phylogenetic data for this region? Does it correlate with conservation across a tree or something?
Well, the thing is that it's really extremely conserved. And I think there are only 3 out of the 9 positions that I ever found that changed somehow across across eukaryotes. So it is a rather theoretical exercise to look into like adaptation on this fitness landscape. And I can't tell you right now whether any of those that I ever found are in this landscape, but I could look it up. Anyways, I mean, on the positive side, maybe make the point that it's not too unrealistic to have never observed any of these before. They were all deleterious in the standard environment. So it might be that if you believe that the lab environment that yeast usually grows in is more resembling the natural environment than this high salinity environment, then it might be reasonable to assume that they have never really popped up, especially in experiments. The nice thing about this landscape is that it is relatively unbiased. So many of the published landscapes, they are based on like a single adaptive walk where people have then dissected the mutations that appeared during that walk and made the landscape out of this, or of single beneficial mutations. But here we have it's clearly not random, but at least a somewhat more random selection of mutations than usual. And also we have these several amino acids at the same position, so we can actually look into the specific amino acid effects, and it somehow creates an even higher like dimensionality of things.
How many of them are single
nucleotide? I'm not exactly sure. So when we created this list, I remember that I looked into ideally finding some that actually, so because we have, for each of them, we have several nucleotide mutations. So I think for most of them, we actually have a path that gets you from one to the other. But I can't tell you right now how many are actually like one nucleotide step away, and whether there's an actual path theoretically in our landscape that would connect them.
The HSV90 is not plasmid,
or is it a genome? So the genomic copy is regulatable, and that's kind of the cool one.
You shut off the...
Exactly. So it's basically used to amplify the library, but then it's shut off when the selection experiment starts.
The unbiased, you know, selection mutations, it's a double-edged sword, right? It's good and bad. Because on the one hand, this landscape is huge, so maybe you want to focus in on just the ones that are...
Yeah. So the 3 questions that I want to talk about today are the following. So the first will be to look at the actual single step mutations, and that gets a little bit back to what you just said. So if we just have the information of the single step mutations, does it give us the information about where the global optimum is located and what fitness we find there? Then the second one will be if we now simulate evolution on the fitness landscape, how likely is it that we actually get to the global optimum of the landscape? And finally, if we use different fitness landscape statistics, how informative, when we just take out some information, will it be about the rest of the fitness landscape? So let's take a look at the landscape just all together. So here now is the mutational distance from the parental sequence. And then on the y-axis is the growth rate that we observe. This is our reference point here, which is here at zero. And then each of the lines connects a single step mutation. And so there are, of course, now also vertical lines because we have several mutations at the same amino acid position. So we can change a mutation without actually changing the distance from the parental type. And so what you can see is that there are quite a few beneficial combinations of mutations, but there's also a very strong negative epistasis where combining these mutations over and over gets you into a very deleterious part of the landscape. And just as a reference, there was one stop codon that we put in there just to get an idea of what really deleterious means in our experiment. So getting to the first question, so we chose three sub-landscapes in order to look into whether single step mutations can give us predict the way to the global optimum. And so the
The stop codon is less deleterious than a combination of.
Yeah, so I mean, this didn't reflect the error in measurements, right? Because since the things that are very deleterious, they deplete during the experiment, and so they become much less prevalent, and so that's why we can't measure them as well. So there's quite a lot more error in deleterious measurements. And we have a statistical approach to get credibility intervals, and they don't all overlap, but it looks pretty good, so it seems to reflect it rather well. So we chose three different landscapes to look into this question whether we can predict the way to the global optimum. The yellow one here is the one that actually gets to the global optimum. So that's those were four mutations that together get you to the global optimum. And we compared this with two other landscapes, where for one we chose just the four best mutations in the landscape, which were not necessarily extremely beneficial, but they were just the four best that we could find. And then the four worst in the sense of most deleterious mutations from the landscape. And we looked into the epistasis and which fitness they could actually get to.
Best just means that if you have this one mutation, that gives you the biggest.
Yes, so it's basically all based on this here, where we just chose the four best ones, the four worst ones, and then the ones that actually give you the optimal.
The worst ones there are two worst ones that are necessary to get to the optimum, and only one best one, so the worst ones are actually important. Or am I misreading that?
No, so I mean, these are the mutations that we have. So what you can, for example, see is that this one belongs to the worst, but it's indistinguishable from the wild type, right?
There's two columns that are in the same column.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
The worst ones are actually important to get to the output.
Yes.
That's cool.
Well, and you will see now that
these all have measurement error too, so they may not be literally the four best or the four worst, right?
But I mean, I think we're relatively confident that these credibility intervals shown here actually reflect quite well the error in the experiment.
But a number of them, so you have two that are clearly way up, but others, I mean, there's a lot of just ones that overlap with each other, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I guess you're right. Yeah, I'm not sure. Well, we actually made the choice of choosing these, but I'm not sure whether. So, for example, for the optimum, I believe that about 98% of, if you draw from, so we get these posterior estimates, and if you draw from the posterior and look into the resulting landscape and choose the optimum landscape, it was with 98%, it was exactly that landscape. So we're relatively confident in the location of the global optimum and what it is combined of.
I have a very dumb question. So these best ones are picked according to this kind of shifting growth frame, right? So
yes.
So why then this, maybe I just don't get it, this N5AAP doesn't have a green dot?
Oh yes, that's because it's at the same position. So these are two mutations at the same position, and so we can't make them both at the same time. Okay, so now let's look at what comes out. So I'm going to show you here the fitness, and then the expected fitness based on the single step mutations, just combining them, versus the observed fitness in the that we could derive from looking at the actual landscape. And so what we saw was that when we take this optimum landscape, then there's a lot of positive epistasis that gets to the on the way to the local to the global optimum, whereas between all of the others, like for the other two landscapes, what we saw was that what is predicted is not at all what we see, but rather we end up in a very deleterious part of the landscape. And
did you calculate the ensemble average epistasis, or did you calculate epistasis according? How do you calculate epistasis? Is it always with reference to the wild type? Or
yes, in that case, it is with reference to the wild type, and later I will talk about a different landscape, like a different epistasis measure. But I think, yeah, it's actually a good point, because I think our ways of measuring epistasis, in that case, it's hugely dependent on what the reference is, right? If we had just chosen whatever else as a reference, then we would have gotten a completely different result. And of course, this reference makes sense in the sense that we actually took it. It actually existed in the lab, right? Whereas many of these genotypes probably never exist anywhere. But at the same time, we put it into a new environment, so it is a rather random starting point for anything, right?
Claudia, is the epistasis for the four-way combination?
Yes. And so there's strong positive and negative epistasis, and I guess naturally now, so the single step mutations do not predict very well where the global optimum is, and also not the fitness at the global optimum. So now let's look at the fitness landscape just from a different perspective. Here now you have just a graph where this is our parental type, and then we have like each genotype is a circle colored by its fitness, and then gray arrows point towards the increasing fitness. And then we can look at those what's going on with like the five. So there we find five local optima that are in the beneficial part of the landscape. So this is just beneficials shown. And then we can look into what happens if we simulate adaptation, well, on the whole landscape, but where does adaptation take us, and how likely is it that we actually get to the global optimum? And so you can do this by using a Markov chain approach, basically, and looking at the probabilities of absorption. And what you can see for this global optimum here is that on average, it's very accessible from anywhere in the landscape. So what this plot here shows you is that if you go from anywhere for any point in the landscape, it calculates the probability of ending up in this global optimum here. And so that it's very enriched here means that there are many places in the landscape from which it's very likely that you will always go to the global optimum. But if you look at the parental type, our starting genotype, then there's only a roughly 25% chance to get to the global optimum.
Sorry, how do you set up the backup chain? You pick one of the arrows at random?
So you start somewhere, and then you look at any arrow that goes upwards, and you basically, the probability of taking a step is relative to the selection benefit that these different types confer.
You cannot take any deleterious.
No, it's a strong selection, weak mutation approximation. So, however, so it's very highly accessible, but if we now look at this local optimum, somewhere else in the landscape, which is which is closer in terms of Hamming distance to the parental type, what we see is that on average it has a much lower probability to be reached from anywhere in the landscape, but it's very likely to attract this parental genotype. So there's almost a 50% chance that you end up in this local optimum when you start at the parental type. And that makes kind of sense, because even though there, on average this global one is very accessible and it's reached from many places, and there are many like walks that somehow end up in the global optimum, this other one is just closer, and so it's more likely to be reached. And so it might be that there's like evolution from this parental type in this case would stall at the local optimum. And so for the third question, we used a different type of fitness landscape statistics that was recently proposed from Guillaume Achard's lab. And that is, it's independent of the reference genotype, and it's based on the correlations between fitness effects on different backgrounds. So if we go back here to our landscape and we just pick two mutations, or like a sub-fitness landscape of dimension 2, then we can look at the effect, for example, of this blue mutation on the without the pink one and with the pink one. And if the effects are exactly the same, then there's in both ways, then there's no epistasis. And that also means that the correlation between those arrows here is perfect in both directions. Conversely, if you have another fitness landscape around there where these two arrows are anti-correlated both ways, then that's what then you get a reciprocal sign epistasis. And if it's true for just one of them, then that's what we call like a sign epistasis. And so the gamma statistic that we've been using basically sums, it picks different genotypes in the landscape, and for each of them it computes all these correlations in all over the landscape, so you get an averaged epistasis for interactions of different mutations. And so when you do this, so there are different ways of summarizing this and averaging or not averaging, but here this is just showing you the footprint of the fitness landscape for interactions between two mutations. And so here now are the different substitutions. And then you can look at how these two interact and whether there's epistasis between them. And if you stare at it long enough, you will see a little bit of a pattern, which is that there seems to be some signature here of epistasis. And in fact, this happens whenever there's a position 5ATA, there's a mutation to a proline. And that's, so one thing that you need to know about this gamma statistic is that it's not symmetric, because it looks at how when one mutation basically happens, what the effect of the next one is. So whenever you have a mutation at 588 to a proline, then what's happening biochemically is that the conformation of the protein is somehow being locked. And so any successive mutation, even though this proline mutation itself is beneficial on its own, but once you lock it, then everything else tends to be very deleterious no matter what effect it had before. And so that's why you have this basically unidirectional epistatic hotspot signature in this landscape here. And so that indicates that there are actually informative things to see from using these statistics on the landscape. Okay, so the second one kind of type of gamma statistic that we calculated is one that actually summarizes over mutational distances. So it calculates the correlations of everything that is like one step apart up to, in our case, of course, 5 steps, because we have 6 mutations in the landscape. And then you can, each different types of landscape leave different signatures. And so here's just a picture for the different theoretical landscapes that exist. And it's not so important to know any of these. But what we did was to actually look at the signature of our landscape and then take some information away and see if we can still see the same signature. So here now is just in blue, you can see the signature of the whole landscape. And then in gray and purple, you see the same signature if you just take one mutation out of the landscape. And so the purple one already shows you that if you take this 588P mutation out of the landscape, you already get a very different signature. But on average, you still have a very similar signature in the landscape. However, if you now go and just take biallelic landscapes, diallelic landscapes instead of the multiallelic landscapes that we had, but still of size 6, then you have 360 sublandscapes, and you can already see that the different signatures go all over the place in that case. And it gets even worse when you look at four-step sublandscapes, in which case you can recover almost any type of signature that could be predicted from types of fitness landscape models. So this indicates that there's a lot of heterogeneity in the landscape, and so local parts of the landscape have very different shapes. So just to summarize this part, on average, our intragenic fitness landscape looks quite rugged, and negative epistasis is common. The global peak seems accessible and is reached through this highly synergistic combination of four mutations. But when evolving from the parental type, adaptation might stall at a local peak.
I have a question about the local peak. Do you have a confidence interval on how robust it's defining that it is actually local maximum?
Yes, I think that's so. We for each of the local optima, we basically calculated the probability of it being a local optimum if you sample from the posteriors. And so, of course, there's some variation, and sometimes you lose some, but it seemed relatively. So we are relatively confident in most of these things. So, but yeah. However, so what we also saw is that so far there's limited predictive potential if we use these types of statistics, but we also got a lot of ideas for the future, which will involve both like finding informative measures and maybe like more mechanistic models of fitness landscapes, so we can actually distinguish them and compare between different types of fitness landscapes. And then what we would really like to do is to understand how fitness landscapes change across environments and, well, also genetic backgrounds, and to generally study the role of epistasis and fitness landscapes across levels of organization, meaning starting from like within the protein, what I talked about today, to within between genes. And I guess even like now I referred so much about microbial interactions, I think in the end there's also a fitness landscape in microbial communities, for example, right? Whether at least presence and absence will give you some type of fitness effect of the population. So that's the first part, and I'm going to just give you a bit of a teaser of one of the projects that's ongoing in the lab, where my postdoc, and her photo is not showing up yet, is looking at the effects of synonymous mutations. So if you think, so we already had the question of whether in this landscape that I presented, we were always thinking about amino acid mutations as single step mutations. And that somehow suggests that you can go from any amino acid to any amino acid as much as you like, but that's not really true, because of course you have to go, well, you have also like whole codon mutations and you have whatever like indels and whatsoever, but I would still argue that most of the mutations are probably single nucleotide mutations, in which case the connectivity of the landscape decreases quite a bit, right? So you can basically cancel out most of the connections here. And now if you look into this on a codon basis, where now each of these squares here represents a different codon colored by the amino acid it codes for, then basically a single amino acid can give you a whole fitness landscape of 64 genotypes that has a specific connectivity and that will give you some kind of fitness landscape and accessibility of different places in this landscape. And so Inesh has been looking into the data that we have published before, where we had these all possible codons and across 9 amino acids in HSP90 in 6 different environments, and she is looking into whether we can see differences in the fitness landscape of synonymous of these single amino acids across environments. And so there are both theoretical questions there, but also rather like applied data-driven ones. So firstly, I mean, we don't even need to need data to ask the question how the structure of the codon table affects adaptation on a fitness landscape, because it clearly it reduces the dimension from 20 to 4, and it also makes paths in generally longer. And there has already been some theory on that. And then secondly, we can ask how does it actually differ across different environments and positions, and which are the underlying factors that make it so different. And I think that we're rather confident that we, for our experimental resolution is high enough that we can actually measure the effects of synonymous mutations. And so we can try to estimate how strong these effects are and whether the actual effects of the synonymous ones, if you don't just say that they are neutral, matter for the shape of this landscape, and which factors can then explain these synonymous effects. And so this was basically motivated by the finding that when I back then looked into all the synonymous mutations, all the mutations that are synonymous to the wild type in our original experiment, already there we saw this one synonymous mutation that seemed to be deleterious across some of the environments that we studied. And just to give you a teaser picture here, so in the hot environment, this is just looking into one of the types of fitness landscape statistics that you can look at. So usually people look at the roughness to slope, which is basically fitting a linear model to your landscape, and then you can characterize the slope as the size of the effects and the roughness as somehow the amount of epistasis in the landscape. And now if you plot these, we just plotted them kind of on the two axes here, and now the light colors represent a fitness landscape in which we assume that each mutation actually has the effect we measured, and the darker ones represent the case in which we just pool the effects of nucleotides together to an amino acid effect. And so although on average you can see that they usually agree relatively well, there are some mutations, so this is for different positions. And so these are basically each cloud represents the fitness landscape of a single amino acid position, and then either split up into having synonymous effects or not. And then here you can see that there are some where it really matters whether you consider synonymous effects as non-neutral versus whether you consider them as being neutral. Okay, so in the next, in the next and final part of my talk, I want to talk about like virus things. And so I'm going to now introduce a couple more evolutionary processes to the models. And I'm also going to say that this is still very much work in progress. And there's also it's quite simulation-based at this moment. So I'm very happy to hear some ideas on how to make this a more.
Just one question, sort of a methodological question about the last part. I mean, you are dealing with very small selection coefficients. You have a lot of power, but I'm wondering about the true replicate. You mentioned, I saw on one of your earlier slides, you said two replicates. Mm-hmm. So would those be two independent constructs of the same genotype, or would those be one construction that was in some sort of blocking design measured twice?
So we have different kinds of things. So for example, for this one here, we basically gathered all the data that we had, and that includes sometimes for the standard environment, I think we have three completely independent replicates.
So and the actual genotype is made three times independently?
I think so, yes. Mm-hmm. And then for the salt ones, on what I showed, we had basically the same library, but two different experiments. So we have different kinds. Unfortunately, we do not have replicants for this is the hot environment, and that there's a limit on the number of replicants you can do. So it's rather difficult sometimes for estimating the actual error and the effect sizes when we don't have one. But yeah, we have a yeah.
Thank you.
So okay. So many of you will know that that RNA viruses are kind of special in the sense that they have super high mutation rates. Here's just a picture from an older paper where they looked into the mutation rates of different viruses. and bacteria. And then you can find like RNA viruses somewhere up here where they have very low, very small genome sizes but very high mutation rates. And that has led to the proposal that you could develop mutagenic drugs to fight such RNA viruses. And interesting. So the theory behind that is actually can be traced back to very classical population genetics, which and especially to the concept of Mahler's redshift, which is the stepwise loss of the fittest genotype that happens due to accumulation of deleterious mutations in asexual populations. And in fact, then if either the mutation rate is too high or the population is too small, the population can go extinct because it accumulates too many deleterious mutations. And this can be happening either through mutation pressure or genetic drift. And of course, you can if for whatever model you use, you can put in like as many, like many beneficial mutations, and you might be able to rescue it. But it's a rather robust effect that whenever you turn up the mutation rate, and eventually you will be able to kill the population. So just to show you a picture here from some simulations, where now here use the mutation rate per genome per generation and the time to extinction. And what you can see is that, so I stopped the simulations at 1,000 generations, but if you turn up the mutation rate, you get to very deterministic extinction times that get very low. And because today what I'm going to show are still like some old figures where the carrying capacity of the population is rather low, which is low. Consistent with what we found in our experiments as the effective population size of our viruses in the lab. This is also robust to population size changes. So for example, here is an example where I fixed the selection coefficient of each deleterious mutation and the mutation rate. And what you can see is that even at very high carrying capacities here, up to 50,000, you can still see very deterministic and short lifetimes of the population.
How do you define extinction?
Oh, extinction in this case is just running, like surviving for 1,000 generation. That is motivated by the, if you think of viruses.
That's survival. Extinction is they're dead.
Exactly. Sorry.
In the genotype, how do you define death?
Let me explain the model, and I hope it will become clear. Otherwise, stop me again. Okay. Okay. So.
Has someone seen by now extinction through Mahler's redshift? Like these experiments, just make a small population size, and you see it.
Sure. Ribavirin. You can totally drive.
Well, you will see in data now that at least with mutagenic drugs you can do it. So this is our real data that came from serial passaging of influenza virus in petri dishes, and then what we got was whole genome sequencing at each passage, and then we could track the allele frequency trajectories and try to infer things like selection coefficients and see, well, I guess we didn't even need whole genome data to actually see that it died at some point when you put in mutagenic drugs. So this is just what it looks like without a drug, and so you can see here the allele frequency trajectories colored by genome position. And we can use these in order to quantify the evolutionary dynamics. And so these are the different treatments that we had in the experiment, and I want you to focus just on two parts here. So this so here you actually don't see that it dies. Well, I guess you can, if you're creative, you can see it. So this is when you have increasing drug treatment, and with this with favipiravir, which is a mutagenic drug that has already been approved for use in Japan, although people seem to be quite careful, so it doesn't seem to sell very, very well at the moment. And so what you can see is that there's clearly like a lot more mutations that are somehow segregating, and then at some point the population just dies. And unfortunately, I don't have a picture of the actual population size that goes down here. But anyways, in that case, the drug was successful at killing the population. But then we also had another treatment where the drug concentration was increased until passage 9 and then kept constant. And even though you still get these trajectories all over the place, in that case, the population survived. And that led us to think about whether there are actually adaptation mechanisms that happen that already have like rescued the population, or what actually can happen such that this kind of treatment might not be effective anymore. And
so is this due to three-valent polyglutarase mutations fixing in the population, or just does every genome carry enough load that they don't work?
Well, we don't know, right? And I think we just have you know, SNP frequencies at each time point.
Oh, but in every read that you get tested with a couple of mutations in very different materials and in very conserved positions, they're probably not going to work.
I'm not sure I understand.
But are you saying, are any of the, say, non-SNOMs SNPs fixed?
Ah, well, I mean, you can, so.
Nothing. Is that, as those, you know, plausible that curious mutations are those mutations that the virus tries to accumulate to rescue them?
Well, I guess our point in the paper was to use these allele frequency trajectories to actually identify something that could be adaptive, right? And so I think that was what motivated me to actually look into this more theoretically, because I don't believe that seeing like a traditional trajectory, like sweep-like trajectory, gives us any information or like a good information, of course. So we've used this method before on normal drugs, and there we could actually identify known resistance mutations, and we could identify some candidates for adaptation to drug treatment. But I think that in this high mutation rate regime, we should be more careful with that. And so that's why I came up with this this project, at least the part that I'm not going to talk about, to actually look into whether we can make any inference from these types of trajectories if we have a lot of deleterious things also around there.
I mean, can I see from the trajectory somehow if the virus dies or survives?
No, and I think at that point I want to make in the next slide here, where I just set up some simulations, and these are three different types of fitness distributions. And so this is just kind of looking at actual allele frequencies over time. Then you have this thick line as the population size, and then you get a bunch of things happening, right? So this is very high mutation rates. And so now I'm not showing you yet which type of distribution of fitness effects this is, but if you just look at it from here, you won't see much of a difference, right? And you won't be able to tell me where we have like actual beneficial mutations or deleterious mutations around. And in fact, those three, there were, the first one is a mix of neutral, deleterious, and beneficial mutations. Then the second one is only beneficial mutations. And the third one is only deleterious mutations. And the way you can see it then is that if you look, for example, at the absolute fitness, once it's increasing slowly, once it's increasing exponentially, and once it's decreasing until you reach this this extinction threshold. And so I think, so that's how this whole thing started. But it also made me think about how viruses adapt to mutagenic drug treatments. And so adaptation in the case of mutagenic drugs, or in general, means that you have like survival or persistence of this pathogen. And then for mutagenic drugs in specific, you can think about which types of mechanisms the virus could use to escape from this, and whether we can detect the signature. And in the end, this is an example of evolutionary rescue, right? Because if you didn't get this adaptation mechanism to come up, then the population would die, but you get something to happen that actually rescues the population. And so I came up with like three potential mechanisms that could rescue the population. So the first one is like traditional beneficial mutations, right? If you had a, if you had so many growth rate increasing beneficials available that you can actually survive for some time, then you can already get the virus to transmit or to whatever, to transmit, and so it might survive in the population despite the drug. But in the end, it's, it will always just be a temporary fix, right? Because any mutation will still be overridden by deleterious mutations at some point. The second would be a quite intuitive one, which is just a mutation rate modifier, where you reduce the mutation rate back to its original level or to something else. And then the third one could be a modifier of the fitness distribution, which would be a mutation that changes mutational effects genome-wide. And that would not result in something like resistance, but it would result in drug tolerance, where you actually, you can maintain the population at high mutation rates despite having, just by changing the distribution of fitness effects.
You would make them larger effects?
And well, it's important to note that you can do it both ways, right? So if you think of just a certain set kind of deleterious effect of each mutation, then you can rescue the population either by making mutational effects weaker, such that you get less kind of that each mutation is fitter than you than before. Or you can also make them stronger, because making them stronger deleterious might stop the redshift, because selection is more efficient.
Where would compensatory mutations fit in here? That is, that you're in some sense increasing the beneficial mutation rate as the fitness declines. If there are a lot of compensatory mutations, it's not clear mm-hmm. that fits under any of those, really.
I guess I would call this, like, count this here, because...
Except you're increasing the number, though, of compensatory mutations as fitness declines, whereas a traditional beneficial one, that would be sort of an underlying
mm-hmm. distribution. So I actually looked at this, too. So normally, I have different types of simulations that I'm currently just using to understand what's going on. And one would always just independently of deleterious ones give you beneficial ones. But you can also just tell the program to, you know, stop whenever you've compensated for something. And so, yeah, I guess that in a way it would be a subcase of this one, where you make it conditional on the deleterious mutation already, that they have already happened. And then it becomes very dependent on the initial fitness, right? Because that's where you can go back to again.
Why do you say that beneficial mutations will not stop the redshift? I'm not sure I understand what's stopping the redshift.
Well, if you have a limited number of them, then you will still get extinction eventually. You will just increase the
An infinite supply of deleterious ones. At some point, you have used all the beneficial ones.
Yes, well, I've played around with different things, but you could, if you imagine an influenza genome, you have 13,000 possible mutations, right? And so you might actually run out of mutations.
But if you, as Rich proposed, if you select a Fisher geometric model array, the more deleterious you are, the more compensatory mutation you have, you reach equilibrium, you're independent of mutation rate.
Mm-hmm, yeah, and there's already some work that exists to actually describe this, but this is not my focus of this. So this thing, I just want to compare these different mechanisms and what happens when you have them available, right? And so, well, I guess in the end, when you think about it, then my claim is that tolerance could be the most dangerous mechanism, right? Because it really, literally, it can really change how the virus behaves by having like either stronger or weaker effects. And it is possible that this appears, for example, through something like a chaperone-ish mutation, or for example, if you open a new reading frame, which is rather possible in influenza, where you suddenly really change the architecture of the genome. Anyways, we don't know yet if it can evolve.
How about gene duplication? I mean, if you have like multiple copies of a gene, and you know, if one of them is mutated, then you can still survive.
Yeah, I guess that would be. I don't know how easy this is in influenza, for example, but certainly. And so, I mean, I'm a theoretician, so for now this is just exists just as a model. But I've been talking with my collaborator at my institute, and she said that if we can come up with different types of things, we could just do like a proof of concept testing and just create these in the lab, because as you will see, it is rather stochastic, right? For certain of these things, you don't. That's the thing about evolutionary rescue, that you have very low probabilities of this happening. And so I think it would be cool to test different ones to actually see whether they can confer a benefit without even showing them that they actually evolve in the lab.
For the modifier thing, I think Richard's question is pretty important, because if you're getting the population to go extinct not from the ratchet clicking, but just from one minus U being below replacement fitness, right? Then you'd say that the modifier wouldn't really help, because your mean fitness is just set by the delta H mutation rate. Right, so that would be if when you see the population go extinct, everybody has a few deleterious alleles, but nothing fixes, right? Then the mind. In that situation where it's not ratchet clicking that's causing the population to go extinct, it might be modifiers don't help.
So in our data, I mean, you saw that nothing really fixed, right, until the very end. I think that's.
But in this.
Those are probably not deleterious, though, right? The ones that fix.
Yes. But we don't know, right?
Yeah.
But in the simulations, the nice thing, I mean, the reason I wanted to look at the trajectories, and so you can actually look at haplotype trajectories and allele frequency trajectories, and then you can figure out what's happening. But in general, they act very, very similarly, right? So you can always find a combination of like whatever carrying capacity and mutation rate that will somehow give you a similar behavior. Anyways.
I'm trying to think about this from the perspective of someone who is developing antiviral treatments. From their perspective, how will they be able to tell which one of your final two scenarios might be happening, or what changes would they want to make in how they treat these viruses? Is it important which one of them is happening? Because ultimately, you're afraid to use the drug, or you're afraid to use it above a certain concentration.
Exactly.
One of these things might be happening. So
I guess the idea would be to look. So for now, I'm just going to show you whether it can invade and in which conditions, right? But the idea, like the kind of long-term idea, would be to actually develop ways of identifying what's going on, and then actually test and whether this is possible, and to get to some recommendation of whether it's dangerous or not, right?
Right. I mean, I can definitely understand from an evolutionary biology point of view why we want to understand, why we want to distinguish between scenarios 2 and 3, let's say. From a clinician's point of view, I'm trying to understand if they also need to understand which one of these two is happening.
Well, I guess the one that has there will be different ways of how they proceed in the population, right? Where the mutation rate modifier maybe, so, I mean, depends on what kind of mechanism it is, right? But it might also reduce the mutation rate once it's transmitted, or it might get back to neutral, so you get basically just are resistant to the drug. Whereas like with this tolerance mechanism, it will result in this fixed mutation that does something crazy, right? And so if you can pass this on, no one knows what's going to happen next. So that's why my personal opinion is that probably the tolerance might be more dangerous.
And just to, I think, add sort of possible at the level of an individual patient, they would, outcomes 2 and 3 would be equally bad, that the drug wouldn't work. But at the public health level, you're saying outcome 3 is especially dangerous because it opens up more evolutionary routes.
Yeah,
in some sense. It has unknown evolvable potential.
Exactly, yeah, that's the...
So in terms of epidemiology, you want to understand which one of these two is happening in a sort of a long term. It has nothing to do, in a sense, with local treatment. It has to do with projecting what might happen in the future. Bottom line, for treatment, stop taking the drug. But long term, what other types of drugs might be better?
Yeah.
This is what, yeah, okay, mm-hmm. Thank you.
So, it's still at the very beginning. And so today I'm going to talk about just showing you like how beneficials extinction times when a mutation rate modifier invades, and which conditions you could get this DFE modifier. And so just like a couple of simulation details. So this is all based currently on a genome with 1,000 loci with a very low carrying capacity, which is consistent with what we estimated as an effective population size in our experiments. And in initial invasion size, that's 10. And then we just set some initial absolute growth rate or fitness of the population. There's an arbitrary distribution of fitness effects, but for today I'm going to look only at like 5% effects, and they will always interact multiplicatively. The mutation rate is also set to 0.3 per genome per generation, and theoretically we can record the haplotypes across generations, and then but that's not what I'm going to show. And we stop if no extinction has occurred after 1,000 generations. And so basically the way the model works is that you have your absolute fitness, which will determine the population size in the next generation through some Poisson probability. And then this is based on the absolute fitness, and you change the fitness of each genotype by accumulating mutations, and that should answer your question. Okay.
And the kind of population sizes that you're kind of estimating in the experiments in the setup would probably be like the size of the least loaded class.
I'm not so sure. It could be. So we have estimates both from I guess maybe yes. But okay. So, this is a boring one where you just look at the number of beneficial mutations that are available and the time to extinction. And what you can see is that at the beginning, you really get only a very, very marginal increase in the extinction times. And then at some point, you go somehow higher with also a higher variance of clonal interference. But you need quite a lot of beneficial mutations here, up to 10%, to actually rescue the population, even though they are not compensatory ones, but they can appear right away and somehow work on rescuing the population.
So where does clonal interference set in here?
I suppose that it increases the variance in extinction times, right? Because you often, depending on whether they appear on the same genotype or not, they will spread to fixation faster or not at all. And so I've been looking at some of the trajectories, and you can sometimes you can quite nicely see it. Okay, so you need a lot of beneficials. Secondly, we can look at the mutation rate modifier. So here is the effect size of this modifier, which means that here there's just no effect. So this is just to show you the extinction times if there was no modifier present. And then you can decrease the mutation rate by a factor 2, a factor 5, or a factor 10. And you can just look at how likely it is that you can actually rescue the population. And then you can compare this with the probability to rescue this if you had this mutation rate in the first place. And so, for example, if we had a mutation rate that was 5 times lower, you would always, you would never go extinct in the first place. And so what you can see is that definitely this thing invades. And if you look at the actual invasion trajectory, it spreads super quickly. And there's still this moment of chance, right? It has to appear early enough to actually rescue the population. And then finally, the DFE modifier. So here I'm going to show you always two plots, where here is basically what the effect of the modifier, where S is modified from this 5% value, which is here, to some other value, either becoming less deleterious or more deleterious. And in order to compare, I'm going to show you here what would happen if you had this specific selection coefficient in the first place without starting at 5%.
So what kind of thing would modify the DFE?
Well, I suppose that it could be, for example, if you had, so at least if on a protein, well, I guess in a chaperone, for example, could do it, right? A mutation in a chaperone that makes you more robust to things. Or in influenza, what you could happen is that you could get a mutation that changes, like a frame shift mutation, such that you open a new reading frame where suddenly the different protein could be read. And I don't know, we haven't been able to easily come up with mechanisms that would change the DFE kind of globally in a virus.
Stabilizing mutation within the protein will also have a global effect on all the other mutations. So that's a local one.
Yeah. Well, it depends on what you count, right? Which?
Actually, I have a small question about how the modifier works. Does it modify all the mutations that have already fixed in the genome?
Yes. So it makes it harder, right? Because it is dependent on the initial genotype. So we could also imagine that it only changes everything that comes after, but I'm not really sure what makes more sense. Anyway, so you might already guess that it's not too easy to get a DFE modifier to evolve, because I'm showing you different genomic target sizes, meaning that how often you actually hit this type of modifier, which is basically a proxy for the mutation rate that you need to actually get this modifier to evolve. Anyway, so if you look at those that actually decrease the effect of the of mutations, then they do super well and they basically invade super quickly and resemble almost what's happening if you just didn't have the stronger selection coefficient in the first place. But then once you look into those that have this basically make things more deleterious, what you see is that it's really rather, it can happen, but it's rather rare to actually rescue the population with one of these, because you really need the mutation to be there right away because of the reason that you can't have already accumulated a lot of deleterious mutations. But, well, I guess the thing is that if you really treat a lot of people with this drug, then and go into like 100,000s, for example, and even if you had a very low mutation rate, you might end up being lucky to, or unlucky, to actually get this to spread. So both types of modifiers can invade, where they have rather different effects. One is just basically behaves very normal, like very predictably, and the other one is very stochastic, but then has a very dramatic effect. So to conclude, we have this extinction process that is rather deterministic over a large range of the parameter space. You need many beneficials in order to rescue. The mutation rate modifiers invade really nicely if they are available. And then you have these DFE modifiers that have a very interesting behavior, and that might be rare, but rather dangerous. Okay, so with this, I want to finish. And yeah, thanks for your attention, and thanks to my lab and all the people who have been involved in this certain things. Maria Joao is the virologist I'm talking with about this. And then, of course, Dan Volon and his people at UMass who produced all the empiric data. And Sebastian, who was my co-author on this on the big fitness landscape paper, and yeah, thanks.
Do you have any evidence of like changing mutation rate? I mean, things like fluorouracil or other before that also based analogs, there's some resistance can link eventually to increase resistance to increase maybe. The ability to discriminate those days and somehow to decrease mutation rate. Is there?
So you mean that whether there's evidence for mutation rate modifiers?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, you saw mutation rate modifiers.
There are high fidelity and low fidelity versions of various polymerases, certainly in HIV, and I think also in flu and polio. But you, the DMV is looking, it looks very different, right?
Yes.
So you have some microscopic fractions mutations that make it lethal.
So what?
Which are effectively lethal.
Mm-hmm.
So some, depending on who you ask, between 30 and 60%
yep.
of mutations, amino acid mutations that is not tolerated.
Mm-hmm.
And that would change your conclusions.
Well, I guess the ones that are very deleterious, they don't matter so much for the ratchet, right?
They don't make
so if you,
but then suggest a different method of actually driving the population extinct, that by having too high a mutation rate, the basic reproductive number goes below one. So if you produce a lot of just non-functional viruses, and then you just wind down, right?
Well,
clicking.
I don't think so. In the end. So if clicking for you means actual fixation of specific mutations, you don't need that for the ratchet, right? So you can have just, it's haplotypes clicking, right? It's not necessarily alleles. You don't need fixation of anything. And so I would argue that it is actually the same process. It's just different classes of mutations. And, well, the idea is to make it somewhat more realistic eventually, but then I would argue that in the end, like for this, like this really fast extinction, they don't matter so much. But in the end, well, the thing is, I had to start with something. My DFE is basically arbitrary, but I didn't want to test like 20 different shapes of DFEs for now, so I just went back to the very classical models where you just have a single deleterious effect.
I have one question about the slide in the beginning of the last part, I mean, where you showed these allele frequencies for beneficials, mixed, and deleterious
mm-hmm.
mutations. And so are you saying that from the just looking at the pattern of these allele frequencies, you wouldn't be able to predict what happens to the population, whether it goes extinct or not?
Well, do you think?
Well, there must be something in these trajectories that you could, if you analyze them, you should be able to tell.
Yes, but I'm not sure. I mean, here this is the beneficial only, and I guess there you have to really just a lot of clonal interference because there are so many of them. If you now reduce the mutation rate, then you would probably get a more classical signature of like different sweeps and so. But here this is deleterious ones only, and it really looks rather similar, right? And you always, so, and that's, I mean, old theory, you have the redshift clicks rather constantly, and you always get cohort fixation. It will always be cohorts, and it doesn't matter whether it's deleterious or beneficial, they will always fix in cohorts.
Well, that's true. I think in that limit, it's really the same, right? It's sort of periodic selection or periodic
mm-hmm.
clicking. Same,
I thought the deleterious only was the bottom one. Was
yeah, that's what
oh,
I
yeah, that's actually
right.
true. Yeah, no,
yeah.
That was beneficial only and mixed, and no, no.
I mean, to my eye, the bottom one I was going to guess was the beneficial selection.
But if you didn't know, if you didn't know that they were all run with the same mutation rate, you wouldn't have guessed, no? Like, because.
I agree with you. It's hard to.
But I think the sign of the interactions between different mutations is different. I mean, you know, beneficial mutations get in each other's way, right? That's what clonal interference
mm-hmm.
means. But I think deleterious ones should somehow
not get in each other's way.
They should be interacting synergistically. At least that's sort of my intuition, so there should be something.
At the mechanistic level, at the epistemic level?
No, just on the level of the
population. Yeah, I agree with that.
It should be easier for them to fix if there are others around. At least this is what we have seen in some models. I think that's, so I think there should be, you know, in terms of once they start interacting, there should be some difference.
So once beneficials and deleterious ones.
Once there is clonal interference or, you know, whatever you call the thing that happens when there are many deleterious mutations around. I mean, you wouldn't call it clonal interference.
I think if the mutation rates you're looking at, they're not distinguishable. Right, in a limit of very high mutation rates, you can just show analytically that these are not distinguishable scenarios.
So if you ran hundreds of these, they'd just...
Yeah, exactly. For lower mutation rates, they're very different.
I see.
basically the condition, right, is NS e to the minus u over s.
Well,
right?
Yeah, here it's like 0.3 or something.
Yeah, I mean, I read your paper, of course. The thing is that it doesn't predict you any, it doesn't give you predictions of extinction times, right? Which is what I'm interested in, and yeah. And still, it doesn't give you a way of using allele frequency trajectories to, so it would, I mean, do you, so it, the question is, can you find anything to do it in that case? So the distributions are indistinguishable, right? Yeah. But is there anything?
I mean, I would say asymptotically they're indistinguishable. Mm-hmm. Anything you can distinguish is the fact that it's not quite, you know, completely infinitesimal, right?
And what were the population sizes in these simulations?
Oh, they are also rather low. It's like 250 or something. And but I mean, I've run it. The problem is that if I do this exercise, it gets very slow at the moment because it's still in the initial phase. So if I run it for higher ones, I just wasn't able to do this for now.
I'm just trying to understand.
But it looks
quite
similar.
How quickly, how some of these deleterious, and they're all deleterious with a fixed 5% disadvantage.
Yes. I think these were just for illustration, and I actually drew a DFE that had like a uniform distribution of some range of the deleterious effects.
I guess I'm just puzzled to see some of those fairly steep rises of individual mm-hmm. deleterious alleles with a genomic mutation rate was what?
0.5.
Isn't that a crazy thing that conditional on fixation, the fixation time for deleterious mutations is the same as
yeah.
the beneficials?
Yeah, so they have to go up either fast or not at all.
So conditional on fixation, they go up fast.
Yeah.
Just like a beneficial.
Yeah.
I think in this case it's a little different, right? They actually are beneficial because they're just less deleterious than the average person.
Yeah, that I think has
so
to be some of
they are actually positively selected.
Are they?
Yeah. They just have, you know, they have three mutations.
It's got six or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, if your average individual has 10 mutations, some of them have three. Okay. They really are positively selected.
I think.
And those three deleterious mutations, they're going to look beneficial because they are.
Do you think
or the absence of the other?
They're better than the average.
Yeah, I think to get those steep rises, that has to be the correct explanation.
Do you think from your theory one could predict when they reach the kind of the threshold and then go extinct? Yeah.
In the actual experiments, the population size isn't kind of crashing from generation one?
No. It's the way that it's, so it depends a bit, so you can either, it depends when you have selection acting, right? If you basically produce whatever, like, I always think of zygotes, right? But if you produce whatever, your new generation, and then you have, like, selection, and then they reproduce, then it's one thing. But if you just draw them according to some relative fitness, then you can maintain the carrying capacity for a long time, and then you get this steep decline.
Yeah, that's actually what you see in the experiments.
Yes.
So it's kind of a soft selection, but then with a limit when you fall below a...
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing.
You
can do the theory for what happens with the deleterious mutations, but then there's an additional mapping of what fitness means with respect to population size. And so there's an ecology side there.
Yeah, that's sort of this is
you have to make something up.
I mean, in a sense, the ecology would be a little bit like our serial transfer, where they're, you know, always able to grow enough to replicate themselves 100-fold each day in our long-term experiment, but at some point they no longer can keep up with that, and then the population crashes. So it looks like there's, I mean, that's essentially
the
soft selection regime, in the sense that the population size doesn't change until you fall below a replacement level, and then you're doomed for extinction.
Yeah.
I guess that's right. You can have some model of the ecology, which is just like there's some absolute fitness-dependent population size, which has some functional form. And then, you know, as long as if you're in a regime where the fitness effects are large compared to the mutation rates and so on, then everything is simple anyway. And if you're not, then probably the absolute fitness is changing slowly compared to the time scale on which, you know. basically that one can treat the population as constant size at all times, and then look at how, at a given constant population size, you know, how quickly are deleterious or beneficial mutations going to accumulate, what's that going to do to absolute fitness, and just map the trajectory of the population through the population size space and get the rate at which it's moving and everything, even without accounting explicitly for changing population size.
But you still have to have a map of how absolute, maybe at some point absolute fitness.
Well, that's some function that you don't know, right?
Yeah,
but one can sort of solve it in principle for any function, I would think.
In the evidence graph, we see the extinction. That those are the ones where you're ramping up the mutation rate.
What?
Ramping up the drug concentration in terms of the mutation rate, I think,
Well, I mean, in these ones, the drug concentration was increased with every step, right? So it was basically doubled. And here it was doubled until passage 9 and then kept constant.
Oh, okay. So, I mean, I'm guessing that, basically you're hitting a point where the drug concentration gets high enough, that the mutation rate gets high enough, that they are, now the pipeline just decreases exponentially because they have one virus burst does not produce a replacement number of healthy viruses.
Well, the question is whether it's actually is it really kind of a linear or whatever linear dependence of like drug concentration and mutation rate? I think it's rather like whether you reach everyone, right? For example, in the population also. So I'm not sure. I mean, per se, I don't think you can say that, right? And I guess we see the increase in mutations right away as compared with the control.
Right. I just think once you bump that mutation rate high enough, that when you multiply burst size times like 1 minus U lethal, it falls below the replacement number.
Oh, yes.
Then
sorry.
I think my guess would be that that's what's going on.
Well, but that's what mutational meltdown is about, right?
No, I mean, you're saying it's based on the deterministic load, like the segregating load, and you're saying it's essentially the fixed load, right?
That, no.
Well, you're saying
it's just like a batch of like only purely people.
I'm sorry. Okay. This is an interesting discussion, but we should continue outside because it's 5 o'clock and the staff wants to clean up and go home.
I mean, does yours work with only purely lethal mutations? Because I think this is all consistent with just only lethal mutations.
Right. Oh, no, and that wouldn't work because they would never accumulate.
Right, so that's what I'm saying. That's the